the way in which corporations are trying to collaborate with communities. Secondary education. Now, not all corporations are doing this. Some corporations simply say that's not our problem and they walk away from it. Others attempt to substitute their own form of education. Still others attempt to supplement elementary and secondary education by offering materials or volunteers or whatever. And lastly, there are some who attempt to become actively involved in school boards and other institutions aimed at controlling public education. In this country, the historical relationship between businesses, corporations, and education has been a mixed one. It's still, in some cases, a very volatile issue. There are some who feel that education should be a preserve and that the interests of business are so narrow and special that the minds of young people will be corrupted if business is allowed to control the curriculum and become too active in public education. The upside of this involvement is that businesses can make a difference in terms of this connection of corporation and community. They do have resources. The downside, of course, is that you may have situations in which a very narrow definition of interest begin to dominate. The challenge, of course, as I'll come to in a moment, is how do you identify the mutual interest? How do you find some way of people seeing a larger picture so that they feel connected to something that is more unified, more integrated than it is segmented and separate? One of the ways in which this society is beginning to respond to that is the creation of school business collaboratives, in which one attempts to create a larger council, if you will, of business people, of labor, educators, some parents, community-based organizations. Those organizations that claim that they have at their heart of interest the future of young people, for example, who are in school, and who recognize that the problem is larger than any one sector. So therefore, you try to get religious leaders and community leaders and business leaders together in a community so that they might find ways to work together in order to address issues such as youth unemployment or young people dropping out of school or older people who don't have the right match of competence skills that will allow them to continue to earn a living and be productive. I won't go into the downside risks of school business collaboratives, but I can simply tell you that they are characterized in general by the same kind of incoherence and antagonism that we tend to find in so many other parts of society. The upside of it is that anybody who can behave in a way that demonstrates that you can have unity yet diversity is someone who is capable of exercising enormous leadership in this society, and particularly around the issues that I'm talking about. Okay. Now, let me briefly talk about those are schools. Corporation and community relations, let's talk about universities. Those organizations that are supposed to be involved with the preservation, creation, and transmission of knowledge. That is the function, the basic function of the university. Now, I've described earlier what's happened over a period of time, that universities have become so self-centered, so internally focused, that they are becoming irrelevant, unfortunately, to some of the pressing social issues and economic problems that we confront. Now, what's important to understand is that if the mission of a university is to preserve, to create, to transmit knowledge, there are three areas where universities demand autonomy. Do not want to be interfered in any way whatsoever. And those three areas or issues are the following. who gets admitted to a university, who teaches in a university, and what is considered acceptable research. Now, the problem we confront is that we live in a society that demands the collaboration between corporations and universities. However, the inability to find ways of working together so that universities do not feel that corporations are dictating to them, you will admit only these type of students, or more importantly, you will only have these types of teachers, or the real issue, certain issues of research are not appropriate. We would like you to do research in other areas. Now, I won't go at length into maybe in the question and answer period we can do this. Universities are desperate for money, and also in some cases desperate to try to reconnect to a larger society in the way that they were 100 years ago around the issues of food and fiber. But in this desire to try to connect, they feel that they're going to violate those three precious values, if you will, independence of admission, appointment of teachers, and research. Anybody who can help universities with those resources and businesses find a larger mission to attach themselves, those individuals can provide the kind of leadership that ultimately will lead to the resolution of some of the unfortunate conditions that people live in this society in particular. Okay, let me wrap this up by giving you, based on my work and thought, some principles of collaboration. And I suppose what I'm suggesting here is that for those of you who might be involved in education, you know, this would have perhaps more relevance than others, although I would suggest that this these principles of collaboration could be useful in a number of settings, even though one is not involved in education. We've looked at a large number of efforts to get corporations and community together to work systematically in a unified fashion to reduce the breakage between people, education, and occupational maintenance. And some of the consequences of looking at dozens and dozens of these collaborative efforts led me to a set of guidelines, principles. The first principle is that the objective in any collaborative effort is to accommodate rather than exclude competing definitions of the problem. Most efforts of collaboration collapse when people insist that there's only one definition of the problem. Okay. Successful acts of collaboration are when you tolerate competing definitions of the problem. Okay. You young people are unemployed. Okay. That's the problem. Some people will say young people in the city of Hartford are unemployed because they're poor, they've never been trained, and they just simply come from a culture that doesn't allow them to get a job. They're just not capable. Another definition of that same problem is that they can't get jobs because most of them are black and Hispanic, and racism is a fact of life. And Jose and Willie don't have as much of a chance to get a job as Sally and William. Third person says, look, none of those young people in Hartford are going to get jobs because if you look at the structure of the economy, those jobs that they would be well suited for are shrinking. Okay. Furthermore, you got labor unions are going to keep them out because they don't want young people competing with adults. So it's the structure of the job market that explains why you have high youth unemployment. My point is simply this, that all three of those definitions of the problem have some truth. If you're trying to get people from various sectors to work together, the first principle is don't force people to say this is the only definition of the problem. You try to facilitate competing definitions. Does that sound like consultation? Secondly, it is important neither to overestimate nor underestimate the capacity of any single organization, any single philosophy or program to provide solutions to the kinds of problems that I'm talking about. That is to say, don't overestimate nor underestimate the capacity of an individual or an idea or an organization to make a difference. Sometimes we are so organized in our own minds, preset as to who's most effective, okay, that we ignore the fact that there may be someone in our midst who has the potential to make a difference, okay, that we've underestimated, or in some cases that we've overestimated and we've put so much burden. So what it suggests is that we try to remain open, okay, and conscious that potential exists in numerous places. One is more likely to succeed in a collaborative effort around education. Third, that once you engage in some collaborative effort, you should have measures of progress and success established from the get-go. Okay? These standards should be understandable, achievable, and acceptable. The point simply is that one has to become rather concrete, and if you can take out certain measures, because sooner or later, people's interest will wane, and they'll begin to ask the question, am I making a difference, or what is this all about? And if you have small benchmarks, then it allows people to sustain the kind of effort and commitment that's required often to solve the kinds of problems that I've been describing. Fourth point, collaboration takes time. Some people want to get together and we can solve the problem overnight. Other people will say, well, it may take a century. So many of the issues that we confront in terms of people, education, human resources will not be resolved overnight. And they call for a degree of patience, a degree of certitude, that in fact, over time, we can make a difference. There's a flip side of that. That it may take time, okay, and we may spend a lot of time working on a process. Okay. Once you develop a collaborative effort, sooner or later, you've got to ask the question, well, now that we're organized, what are we going to do? Okay. Then you spend so much time sort of getting that process together that you say, okay, what is it that we really are going to do? Who's going to pay? Terms of time, effort, or whatever, and how will we know whether we in fact have made a difference? Seventh sort of principle is that there are always good reasons not to do anything vis-a-vis a problem, and the question is whether the risks of not doing anything outweigh the risks of doing something. But in terms of educational collaboration and getting corporations and communities together, one has to step up to that question squarely and ask yourself, you know, are the reasons for doing something outweigh the reasons for not doing anything? And it may be that there aren't good reasons for doing anything, at which point one redirects into efforts in other areas. Collaboration is facilitated by the establishment of a neutral turf. That when you get people from differing points of view who may historically have been suspicious of motives, etc., and despite the fact that there may be a general consensus that the educational needs of our community are such that we must come together from various sectors, you will be more successful if you find a neutral turf. And the neutral turf can be a place, it can be an organization, but basically a neutral turf is psychological space in your mind. How one develops that kind of space has to do with one's spiritual life. But in the real world, you're more successful in collaborating if you can find the neutral space. Ninthly, collaboration requires buffering. Buffering is a relationship where individual self and other occupy the same time, same space, but we can't deal with each other directly. We go through an intermediary. It could be a broker, counselor, there are various ways of buffering, but the point is that often you have to have the neutral space and some kind of buffering mechanism that allows people who have not experienced any kind of unity to begin to kind of come together around a set of problems of education and training. 10th, collaboration requires regular, if not full-time, attention. Most of the efforts around the country to solve the problems of people, education, occupational maintenance, a lot of good heart, a couple of good speeches, but nobody puts the resources there to allow for regular full-time attention. As a result, when it doesn't happen, 6 months later, the effort falls apart, and people become more frustrated, and they don't realize that it was the absence of resources from the beginning and full-time attention that prevented the success. Lastly, when you're talking about large corporations, it is assumed that the corporation itself is internally well-organized, internally coherent. And so therefore, when you sit down with the vice president of human resources and ask that person to engage with other people to create educational training programs for young people or adults, the assumption is that the vice president of human resources speaks coherently and from an organization that's coherent, not speaks. So therefore, large corporations have to make a commitment themselves to create a unit within that organization that's responsible for working with parents, community groups, or community-based organizations, if you will, around collaboration and education and training. Now, since it's an association for Baha'i Studies, I wanted to close my comments on issues having to do with research. Because one of the unfortunate consequences of the changes in the relationships between business and education is that while research is a basic purpose of the university, what tended to happen over a period of time is that the business of research, if you will, has become unprofitable. That is to say, the results of all of the studies that come out of universities and the money that's being spent has not produced the kind of useful knowledge to people who are trying to solve problems. Basically, what you tend to see are research that reinvents the wheel, or research that is used as a way of forestalling real action on a problem. Another criticism, if you will, of research is that it has become enamored with itself, and researchers have developed, particularly in the social sciences and education, developed their own special words, their own jargon. Okay. And so when they speak publicly, very few people can understand what they're saying, except those who are also involved in reading and writing the journal. I should tell you that that in itself is a profession. University of Massachusetts subscribes to something like 18,000 journals. And there are a lot of people whose lives are spent writing for those 18,000 journals. But what they do is they take a little bit of the old and maybe one little idea and you wrap it up and produce another article. Certainly our own journal will not be criticized for that. But the point being is that people who are involved in research around issues of education, training, human development, etc., we've got to come up with a language that is more useful in its terms to people, everyday people, who are trying to wrestle with the kinds of issues and questions I've described. I think also those people who are in education, one should realize that there are fundamental differences between education as an enterprise and business. And when one attempts to collaborate to solve problems, to recognize that those two different environments are going to have to be accommodated, one is going to have to learn to manage that kind of diversity. In academia, authority rests with the professor or the person in charge of the research project. In industry, it rests with the manager. In universities and schools, learning is heavily associated with the acquisition of knowledge. In the business world, people are concerned with the application of knowledge. Okay, so acquisition versus application. In academia, a premium is placed upon individual performance. In industry, teamwork is key. In academia or in school, success is measured in terms of grades or in terms of tenure, promotion. In business, success is measured by profit. Now, it seems to me that there are some areas of compromise between these two different environments. One would be to reconsider the value of individual research. The fact is that we have such a tradition of individualism that we ask people to solve problems as individuals. We train them to pretend to solve problems as individuals. When in fact what's beginning to happen is that the problems are so complex, you need teamwork. You need a group of people working together in order to solve the problem. Okay. How does one begin to exercise leadership to develop teamwork? I suggest that there are answers there in terms of the principles of the faith. But we confront right now in the training, I mean, that's one of the problems why an engineering graduate from MIT takes them 18 months before they can really be effective in solving problems, engineering problems in corporations. Now, that's disgraceful. I won't talk about lawyers or doctors or teachers or whatever. One of the reasons is that the methods that we've used to educate people, this notion of individualism, and that if in fact we work closely together, you're going to get credit and I won't, etc., that's diametrically opposed to what in fact is happening in society and the kinds of problems that we have to solve. So it may very well be that schools and corporations, as they work together, as they collaborate, they can compromise and find ways of encouraging group. Similarly, the issue of once you've acquired a solution, how do you disseminate that? And again, it comes back to the kind of language. How does one synthesize? It seems to me that a precondition to synthesis, at least, is the notion of seeing life, of seeing things connected, as opposed to seeing things separate. And if, in fact, one begins to develop that kind of consciousness, then it becomes easier to look for ways in research or in joint efforts to emphasize synergism, to emphasize a synthesizing, and therefore, as a result, facilitating the sharing of that kind of knowledge. Lastly, we need research on the process itself of collaboration. What does it take to get people from different points of view, different experiences, to work together? And it seems to me that in the faith, we have the principles that suggest that if in fact you make certain assumptions, it's going to be easier. Okay? That's the claim that we make to non-Baha'is, that somehow or another we can take people, regardless of accident of birth, and somehow or another we can pull people together so that we can occupy the same time and space and we can solve problems. Not that we're perfect, but the point being is that we can overcome the segmentation of society and the kind of division, and we do it better. Well, for those people who are involved in educational research or development or whatever, the challenge to you is to come up with theoretical models and frameworks, okay, and describe them in lay terms, but understand that they're connected to some larger notion of God, if you will, and that if, in fact, you can connect your spiritual life with your intellectual life, you are in a process, and you'll have the capacity to make a contribution to some of the most important issues that confront American society, and that really has to do with people. Education and occupational maintenance. And on that point, I will stop. We've got 10 minutes, and take your questions.